To ask Mr. Causal tonight, does the dollar become a factor in our education today? And what part does politics play? And especially for the people in New York, where the decentralization issue is so prominent in the news today, people are asking for answers. Death at an early age is a deeply disturbing, fully documented account of a teacher's year in a dominantly Negro school, a school that happens to be in Boston, but, as I said earlier, might be found in any number of American cities. Mr. Causal was assigned a fourth grade class as part of a program designed to upgrade the segregated schools. And 2 weeks before the end of the academic year, Mr. Causal lost his job. He was fired by the authorities for introducing to his pupils a poem by a widely recognized Negro writer who was Langston Hughes, whose work did not happen to be listed in the approved curriculum. Our guest, Mr. Causal, is standing by, and we will be happy to welcome him. Mr. Causal? Welcome to Night Call.
Thank you.
And forgive us for our lateness. We had a little problem on this end, but thank you so very much.
It's okay.
I don't know if you had a chance to hear our opening. And just before I pose my first question to you, just so that you'll be familiar with the groundwork that we are going to present you with, our opening stated that right now some 500,000 non-white unemployed Americans between the ages of 16 and 21... Most of these are black, many of them are high school dropouts. And many of those who don't drop out are not much better off. And consider for a moment the recent survey that showed many black New York City high school seniors reading at a sixth grade level. Our guest tonight, Mr. Jonathan Causal, says that death, spiritual and psychological death, comes to these youngsters at a much earlier age, long before they get to high school in the lower elementary grades of our urban ghetto public school systems. The award-winning book was published about a year ago, and its subtitle is The Destruction of the Hearts and Minds of Negro Children in the Boston Public Schools, and describes what Mr. Causal learned while he was a fourth-grade teacher in Boston's Roxbury Ghetto. In its review of his book, the Christian Science Monitor said that while Mr. Causal was writing specifically about the Boston Public Schools, he could be writing about the school system in almost any city in the country. And right now he's standing by. Our first question to you, sir. It's been just about a year since your book was published. Has there been any notable progress in the past 12 months or so? Or do our black youngsters in ghetto schools continue to be the victims of death at an early age?
I think that there's been a very modest change in Boston and Pittsburgh and Chicago and other cities that I've visited. I think some of the more blatant kinds of racism that I described in my book have been covered over in Boston. I don't think teachers any longer sit around in the teacher's room in Boston chatting about the niggers up in room four the way they used to when I was there. I know that they don't use the whip, the stick, as the kids call it, the rattan whip, so much in Boston. At least they're more careful about the conditions under which they use it. I think that the most blatant of the bigoted textbooks, like some of the ones I quoted in my book, the one that said the Union of South Africa was, you know, one of the most democratic countries on earth, that's a standard Alan and Bacon textbook. I think most of these things have been, you know, taken away because it's easy to get rid of the obvious things. But I think that, you know, the deepest kind of cancer is still there. And, you see it lots of ways in Boston. The black community is still, you know, ruled out as far as any kind of considerations, not even talking about control, just talking about communication. Things are done in the schools, you know, without any reference to the will of the black community. The school in which I taught, I think, is a good example. There have been three principals in 3 years. The teacher turnover has been constant. This year, 20 of 30 teachers failed to return. They still do whip kids there carelessly, as a matter of fact, as they did before. Principals try to be more careful, but sometimes the racism of the teachers, you know, still runs ahead of them. One fifth grade teacher took a chunk out of a kid's arm last spring one day. And at least this has changed. The black community 3 years ago would have accepted that as its, you know, as its slave-like destiny, and today it's taking that man to court. I think that's different. And, perhaps the only other thing, you know, that's different is that the black community has ceased kind of pleading for mercy and integration from our local school committee, and it has, you know, while it still works for integrated schooling under conditions that would be suitable. It's more interested now, really, in having a say in what's going on in the neighborhood. And this past week, the parents actually took over one of the schools in Boston. They were driven out by the police, but they at least had the guts to walk in and install their own principal for a day. That happened to be the school that my book was about.
Throughout the country, the educational system seems to be, for lack of another word at this point, under attack. The teachers are getting involved in the unions. They're asking for better pay, better conditions. Many of the communities are asking for control. What is the central problem here?
Well, I think the central problem, you know, here is the same one as in business, as in the financial world. It's a sense of powerlessness. It's a sense that, you know, democratic process or no, somehow the school boards and the teachers and principals they've deputized are not responsive to the will of people who happen to be poor and black or Spanish-speaking or Indian, or in some cases, poor Irish or poor Polish or poor Jewish or whatever they are. In this case, it tends to be poor black. And you see it so vividly in this city. I think Boston's a good city to look at, and maybe that's why my book was not so difficult to write, because it's small enough. A lot of these things which are almost incomprehensible in New York seem crystallized in Boston. And you have a situation like this past summer where this school, which was the subject of my book, which had been disputed about and argued about repeatedly, was about to have its third principal. The black community very gently, very intelligently and soberly and not militantly asked the school system to allow its leaders to have some kind of logical say in the next principal. They weren't saying, you know, we want Stokely Carmichael running our school, but they were saying, let us in on the discussion. The school system utterly ignored them, put in a typical old Boston, you know, political principal, and created a revolution. This is the demand, and I, as a white man who by all odds ought to be identified with the establishment in this city, I see all the right, all the logic, and all the, you know, the real democracy on the side of the angry parent.
Well, do you see the control of the schools being taken over by the black community as a step in the right direction?
Well, I do. I do. If a situation's been created where there is such evil feeling already in the air that no white teacher can even talk to a black parent, then you're in a disaster area already, and then I don't know whether anything will work. But if you're in a situation such as the one we have in Boston and in most American cities at this time, where there is some possibility for a liaison between the parent and the teacher, and where the unions are not terrified, you know, where they're not bristling with enmity and suspicion about their professional rights and privileges and security, and when they're not scared of, you know, seeing a black parent, then I think it can work. And I think one of the most pertinent comments on all of this has been made by the leader of the militant black community in Boston. When they tried to take over the Gibson School, this is the school in question, he said that a lot of teachers were, you know, frightened that they were going to lose their jobs if black people took over the school. And he said we wouldn't want teachers in our school who weren't concerned about their jobs, because we want stable people who are interested in their own career. And he said, we are not asking only for black teachers, and we are not asking only for radical teachers, and we are not asking only for militant teachers. We are just asking for decent teachers, and we want to have a say in who they are. And I think that this is what democracy is all about, and I think that some of the unions in the country are going to be responsive to it, and some aren't. unfortunately.
Am I right in assuming that a teacher who has prejudiced feelings or has prejudiced feelings against blacks, that this attitude is brought into the classroom?
Oh, I don't see how it could happen, you know, but into the classroom. If you can hide it, you can make all the customary, you know, statements of benevolence, and, you know, the teachers in Boston, I always used to hear them, older ladies sort of saying to me, well, so-and-so, Miss O'Dougal down the hall, she's very prejudiced, but I'm not, to me, they're all the same. They're black skin or white skin, they're all made by God. I see no difference. I heard so many white teachers tell me they see no difference. They don't know, they don't even notice which children are black. And I always, you know, wonder about their vision. I always, you know, say, you know, who are you fooling? You know, a child is black, it's darker than a child is white. You know, why play the game? And so many teachers think that they don't bring it into the classroom. But it's obvious. It comes out in lots of subtle ways. I mean, you don't have to look for the teacher who calls the children niggers. There was a teacher in my school, I remember, I refer in my book, I called the art teacher, who used to love to hold up the artwork that had been done by the white kids in previous generations. That happened in this case. Those would have been mainly Jewish and Irish children. In other cities, it would have been another white minority. She'd hold up these pictures, which were very neat and very uniform and kind of pretty, and she'd say to the children, oh, and she'd say this so the black kids could hear her. She'd say, oh, we used to do wonderful work in this building in the old days, and then to me, in a soft voice, with the other kind of child. And then she did it often. She would make a gesture with her fingers as though she was feeling cloth, you know, as though we were talking about textures, good cloth and bad cloth, and she, like a tailor's gesture, and she would say, with the other kind of material, with the other kind of child, we could do some beautiful work, but not these children. And then she'd stick these pictures up on the wall, and the art lesson would sort of be to copy them, to fill in mimeograph designs and do what the children had done before. Well, you know, first of all, it was insulting to the children in front of us to assume that they couldn't do as well as the kids before. It was also stupid to expect that they would want to do the same as the children before. And she, you know, in the long run, was cheating herself because she failed to consider that these kids might do something different, which might be exciting and might teach her something that she didn't know before. And I don't think it's a question of a particular teacher who is a demon, you know, who is sadistic. I just think it's a strain which runs right through almost all of us. And
Mr. Kozel, yeah. We'll return right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Jonathan Kozol after station identification.
Because I happen to be black, every once in a while someone asks me what I really want. Well, the answer is simple enough. I want what every wife and mother wants. I want a job for my husband so I can stay home and mind the children. I want the prices in the stores in my neighborhood to be the same as anywhere else. I want clean streets, safe streets, a place for my children to play. I want my children to have the same chance at a good education as other children, so they'll have a chance at a better life than I've had. If I wanted any less for my family than other mothers want, what kind of mother would I be?
It isn't easy to get by in the cities these days, for blacks or whites. Our cities need help, your help. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder. Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call to Jonathan Kozol about ghetto schools. Again, Del Shields.
Death at an early age, the spiritual and psychological murder of black youngsters by our ghetto schools. Our guest tonight, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, and he's standing by in Boston, ready to take calls. So we'll take our first call tonight from Brooklyn, New York. Miss Babatoon is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Miss Babatoon, good evening.
Good evening, Del.
How are you?
Fine.
Your question?
My question is, statement. I feel and strongly believe that the death at an early age began in school, excuse me, with young people. When they go to school, the only thing they are taught is of the white man. And the only thing they possibly can learn is of the white man. And any possible learning of their own race deals with only slavery and with a mockery, more or less. Don't you feel so?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the first of all, what you say is the death begins very young. It's interesting that in our city, where a lot of tests have been given in recent years, black kids tend to enter the school system at grade level, according to the national norm, in terms of, pre-reading status and readiness to learn and so forth. By sixth grade, they're often 2 years behind. So it's clear that it's within these years that the child, is somehow smashed by the system. And I think those statistics also say something about the whole argument that it's the fault of the home and so forth, because whatever the home, the bright kids coming into the school seem to be okay in Boston. But if something happens between first grade and sixth, and I think the main point is the one you made, that the kids get so little that has to do with their own identity, and when it is something of their own identity, it's always sort of insipid identity. In Boston, for example, we have 1 week a year called Negro History Week, and during that week they'd haul out all the safe, castrated Negro heroes that the white world approved of: Booker T. Washington, Marian Anderson, a teacher who hated opera and didn't like Negroes would clasp her hands and listen to the old scratchy Marian Anderson racket, and she'd say, "Oh, don't they have wonderful rhythm?" And then we'd get the standard lesson of George Washington Carver and the 200 or 300 things that he made out of the peanut and so forth. And all of this was a white man's Negro, And then I'd come in with something timidly modern and hardly radical, like the poetry of a good black poet, Langston Hughes. And I'd be told, well, we don't need Langston Hughes because we've already got Paul Dunbar, the Negro poet of another century, and I'm trying to discriminate between the words. And later in the year, as you probably know, in June, I was fired from the Boston school system forever for reading my kids a single poem by Langston Hughes, and told I could never teach in this school system again.
Well, personally, I think the whole school system is completely prejudiced, completely without a doubt. Besides the history that we are taught, when children are, going to third, fourth grade, they're at that curious age as to what, when, and how. And not necessarily can they come home and ask mommy, because mommy doesn't know, neither do daddy, because in their time they still had to be taught about the white man again. And this is reasons why we have slower children.
Well, mommy and daddy have often been brainwashed themselves when they were in school.
Definitely.
Isn't that the point you were making?
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that instead of us, not us, but instead of the system taking the children from the third grade and throwing them into the fourth grade without them even knowing first grade work, I think they should stop for at least 5 minutes or so and, go over it as much as they possibly can. Because if you take a child who's ready for high school and can't read third grade level, what good is that? And
right.
Then you get a diploma saying that you were in school for 12 years. And
well, automatic promotions are one of the ways in which inner city school systems try to conceal their failure to educate black children. That's the point. Just a final sort of epilogue to what you were saying about a black child in those early years. I remember kids who were second, third, fourth graders in my school I'd spend time with them on the weekend with my girlfriend, and their reaction, she was a girl with long hair down to her waist, and the girls would stroke her hair, and they would say to her, "You have good hair." Mm-hmm. Well, she and I would just look at each other terrified, because we could only, say this is what our schools have done to children.
Ms. Babatoun, thank you so much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
This is Night Call in New York, Death at an Early Age, the Spiritual and Psychological Murder of Black Youngsters by Our Ghetto Schools. Our guest tonight, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, who is the author of the National Book Award-winning book, and it's a book I think that all Night Call listeners should have as a part of their library, and we certainly hope that you're going to get it. In the meantime, we'll go to Atlanta, Georgia, and Mr. Britton is standing by. He's hearing Night Call over WAOK. Mr. Britton, good evening, sir.
Good evening.
How are you?
All right. I have a question. I go to an integrated school, mm-hmm. and...
How old are you, sir?
14.
How old?
14.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
And in my fifth period, I take Spanish. And the white teacher in there, she doesn't call on the Negroes in there. And I would like to know, what should I do about this? I mean, she doesn't pay us any attention at all.
Yeah, well, this is, I want to be responsible and careful, and of course, I don't know what the total situation is in the classroom or in Atlanta, and I don't want to, give any listener the license to accuse me of rabble-rousing. On the other hand, damn it, you've asked, a pretty straight question, and the kind of thing which apparently has happened throughout the country, because last November I was with a group of kids in Washington who were in integrated schools all over the country, and that story kept coming up, the one you just told. See, one thing you should know is you're not alone. That's happening out in California, and it's happening in Boston, and it's happening in Illinois. It's happening everywhere now. What do you do? I would suggest, even if it'll take guts to do this, that you ask that teacher, if you could talk to her. Is it a woman?
Yes.
Yeah. Ask her if you can talk to her alone, and go to her and really lay it on the line and say to her, "We don't think that you like us, or we don't think you want to listen to us," and give her a chance, to see what she will say. It's just possible that she is unconsciously, racist and doesn't understand what she's doing. She might come in there with that assumption that none of you kids, meaning the black kids, are capable of giving an answer. If you confront her that way, possibly you'll teach her something. And just possibly, you'll help her to save her soul. But if it doesn't work, if I were you, I would go... I would maybe try one step further and go to the school administration, maybe that's the principal, and then take it to your own community. There must be a parent organization in your neighborhood, isn't there? Some kind of black group that knows what's going on?
Yes.
Have you ever told them about this?
Well, no. This is the first year it occurred.
Why aren't you?
Well, Mr. Kozol, in a situation like that, doesn't the student leave himself open to have to suffer the wrath of a teacher who may not be willing to hear a student say to him or ask him about his particular prejudice, or ask him why he is not being called upon?
Yeah, you're right, and possibly the suggestion I made, is making it harder for the student, but. There are teachers who will retaliate. That's what you mean, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, there are teachers who will retaliate and will say, damn it, I said you're stupid, and you're stupid, and I'm going to prove it now. I'm going to flunk you. But I guess I said that out of a wistful hope, that more people than not are capable of learning from a student if the student goes to them with some kind of solid argument. If you can somehow prove it, by saying, "Look, 10 times in a row I raised my hand and you would not call on me." However, possibly Mr. Shield is right that you'd be that the teacher will retaliate.
What would happen if all of the black students in that particular class would ask for a meeting with the teacher?
Well, I think that, you know, what you're talking about now really is also what would happen when all the parents wake up and ask a good, strong question. I suggest that perhaps before you do it, you get some of your fellow black students to go with you and do it together. Try at first not to seem to be threatening the teacher so that the teacher, you know, will have a chance.
Well, Mr. Burton, may I ask you this? Do you feel the teacher is prejudiced?
Yes.
Why?
Because sometimes she'd be going down the row, calling people to answer, and then she'll just skip over the black children's. And call all the whites. And then, rather than come back to us, she'll ask someone else the same question over again.
All right, you stay tuned, and possibly before we go off tonight, we may have a teacher who may call in and may have some additional advice for you. Okay?
All right.
Thank you for calling, sir, and good luck to you.
All right.
This is NyCall in New York. We will return to our guest, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the NyCall Network.
More NyCall with Del Shields and guest Jonathan Kozol after station identification. Next week on Night Call, a black Puerto Rican, a white civil rights priest, a Zionist rabbi, a socialist presidential candidate, and a radical Episcopalian minister. Monday, author Peary Thomas on blacks, whites, and Puerto Ricans. Tuesday, civil rights leader Father James Groppi on open housing. Wednesday, Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum of the American Jewish Committee on the Middle East crisis. Thursday, presidential candidate Henning Blomain of the Socialist Workers' Party. And Friday, the Reverend Malcolm Boyd, radical Episcopalian minister, author of Are You Running With Me, Jesus?, a Yale fellow this year, on dropouts from the American dream. All this next week on Night Call. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call to Jonathan Kozol about ghetto schools. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us nightly for the second half hour. Tonight, Death at an Early Age, the Spiritual and Psychological Murder of Black Youngsters by Our Ghetto Schools. And our author of the book tonight, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, is with us, calling in from Boston. Remember our numbers in New York? It's 866-5010. Our national telephone number is area code 212-749-3311. And on the West Coast, it's 866-5... I'm sorry, on the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That number again for the West Coast listeners, area code 212-749-3357. And in New York, 866-5010. We'll take our first call during our second half hour from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mr. Sable is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. Mr. Sable, good evening, sir.
Tell me how to get officials to support integrated schooling, you know, where they bus minority groups around to different parts of the city. How you could get officials to be for that when they're against it, when they're totally against it.
Well, are you speaking of local or national?
Local, right here in Milwaukee, because Milwaukee is a very conservative town, and it has more blue laws than Boston, actually.
Yeah.
So could you tell me how you could get officials to be for integrated busing or schooling?
Well, that's like asking how you get sons of bitches to be nice people. And I think you're being generous to Milwaukee when you call it simply a conservative town, from what I've heard in recent months. The only thing I can say is that there are school guidelines, and there is supposedly a Civil Rights Act, and again, supposedly, money that comes to local school systems from the Office of Education carries very strict regulations as to, you know, whether or not the school system is trying, you know, with all reasonable speed to achieve integration. The only thing, of course, is that most local school systems, like the one in Boston, gladly accept the federal money and then thumb their nose at the law, and nobody in Washington seems to have the guts to do anything about it. Sometimes local pressure groups are strong enough to, you know, raise a real storm in the press, and if you're lucky enough maybe to have one decent newspaper in your city, you know, they will support you. In Boston, there is an outstanding liberal newspaper, the Boston Globe, that has been fighting along this line for quite a while. I suspect that, you know, is the channel you've got to follow. You know, you've got to pull in the suburbanites who care, and you've got to get to the people, you know, like the priests and the rabbis and the ministers who are willing to stick out their necks and build this kind of group. And you know what? Then you'll probably say to me, "Well, what if that doesn't work?" And the school superintendent still ignores you, you know. And the only answer I can give you at that point is, well, that's the time, it seems to me, when the black community better just walk into the principal's office and start running their own school.
Yes, I saw that too.
Do you feel that busing will solve the problem?
Do I?
Yes.
Yes, I think it will help solve the problem of prejudice, because children don't know what prejudice is, and prejudice is more or less taught as you get older by hearing things which the adults say. And I'd like to know, don't you think there should be a federal law saying that all school districts should have history books in which all minority groups are taught about, you know, their contributions to this country?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that's a great idea. There should be such a law. There also ought to be a federal law that in a national election we have a choice, you know, between two parties, rather than an election in which, you know, we have three profiles running for office against each other. We also ought to have a law that the president has to uphold the Constitution in its true spirit. I don't mean to sound cynical, but I feel discouraged at the moment. I feel very discouraged tonight, I might say, because in my city, in Boston, tonight, the most reactionary, regressive, and anti-Negro member of our school board has just won a sweeping victory in the primary to become a sheriff. So we in Boston, which, you know, was supposed to be the cradle of liberty, seem to be coming full circle back to Alabama and Mississippi.
Well, Milwaukee is a lot like a southern town, too.
Yeah.
Racial attitudes gone.
Mr. Sable, thank you for calling, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
This is Night Call in New York. Area code 212-749-3311. That's our national telephone number. And, of course, we welcome your calls collect. And we welcome your comments, as well as your conversations with our guest tonight, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, the author of Death at an Early Age. For our West Coast listeners, as well as Colorado, Montana, New Mexico, and in Texas, that telephone number is area code 212-749-3357. And, of course, in New York, it's 866-5010. To Atlanta, Georgia, for our next comment, this time Miss Miles is hearing Night Call over WAOK. Miss Miles, good evening. Your question.
I'd like to ask Mr. Kozol first I'd like to say that I was very impressed with his book, Death at an Early Age, impressed to the point of tears at many places because it was so real and so vivid and so memorable from my own experience as an elementary school student. And I'd like to ask him if he can point to things in his childhood and the things that made him what he is, that gave him the sensitivity and the awareness that he demonstrates in this book. What can he say about himself that perhaps, hopefully, could be found in others of the same sensitivity?
Well, you know what I'd really rather do, with all gratitude to you for compliments I don't deserve. What I'd really like to do is try to divert attention away from me, because I think one of the things that, you know, that a lot of black people justly resent, and those of your listeners who read The Nation might remember a review which discussed this. It was a nice review, but it made a good point to this effect. So many people become more interested than so many people become interested in the white teacher, you know, and sort of forget, and I know you don't, I don't mean to insult you, but sort of forget what it's all about. Forget the murder at stake and forget the black kids. There have been a number of books written about urban education recently, and a lot of white teachers have become nationally known, and people, you know, sort of talk a great deal about their education and their motives and their decency or whatever, and stop and sort of forget that behind it is a disaster area of despair. So, you know, what I would rather do is sort of ask the question, what is it which pulled me close to the black community and enabled me to feel a very strong loyalty to the leaders of the community in Boston and in New York and elsewhere, rather than to the system or to the teachers' union or something of that sort. And I think there's something to be said. First of all, I was lucky. Before I became a teacher, I had spent a summer having a marvelous time working in the black community in Boston. I went there like a lot of liberals, thinking I was going to do good, you know, for the poor, and I ended up doing good for myself by having, you know, having a wonderful discovery of some great children, really having fun, and just having a great learning experience of my own, and then having become intimate with the families of a lot of the kids, completely sharing their sense of impatience with the school system, then I became a teacher. You know, I had the feeling that the people above me in my school always resented this and felt that I'd gotten into education by the back door because I knew the community before I had taken all my courses. Maybe this is the only guideline. Perhaps what our ed schools should be doing is having more of their seminars right in the block where the teacher's going to be working, and put some of those white sociologists who are experts in Negroes out of work, and let some of the black people teach those courses instead. I think maybe this, you know, this is the lesson.
Well, in your own background, as a youngster, did you see any similarities between your feelings and those of the youngsters that possibly you were teaching?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, yeah. First of all, in my own life, there is a bit of poetic irony, because my dad started out in the Boston ghetto, which at that time, of course, was a white ghetto, a Jewish ghetto, and I. In a curious reversal of the American success story, I end up after college and Oxford and all, I end up back in the almost the block where he was born. So that perhaps is part of it, but I think more to the point is that all education in America has some of these destructive qualities. And when I was little, I had a lot of good teachers. It happened. I was in a good school system, but I think the same general problem obtained, which was that teachers were more interested in talking to me and telling me things than they were in listening to me. It's very hard for people to learn how to listen, and I think this is a standard problem in American education. When you add racism to it, Then you have the kind of educational genocide that I've described.
Well, actually, Mr. Kunzel, I don't think that you are being fair by not accepting the description of being a very rare and sensitive person. And I think it's very important for someone like you, for someone who has this rare gift of seeing and not hiding behind all sorts of facades, to share with those who are listening and those who perhaps may they hear about what you said tonight, share what there is about your early life or your development to this wonderful person or to this person, this real person, so that others may perhaps discern this about some people about them or help others move in the direction that you are in.
Well, Miss Miles, I think you have said it. I think you said it for him.
There's a woman named Louise Day Hicks in Boston who wouldn't agree with you.
Well, I don't agree with her.
Miss Miles, thank you so much for calling.
All right. All right.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Jonathan Kozol after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call. Sure, it's terrible and I'd like to do something, but what can just one person do? Just what do these poor black people want anyway? Sound familiar? These are the sort of questions being asked from one end of the country to the other. One man, Donald Bourgeois, came up with an answer for St. Louis called the Block Partnership Program. Its success has led to a similar operation in Dallas. And now Donald Bourgeois is trying to apply the lessons he learned on a national basis for the Urban Coalition. Block Partnership is just what it sounds like. A group of more fortunate citizens get in touch with a ghetto group or vice versa. A dialogue is established. A goal is set up. Blacks and whites work together to save our city. Donald Bourgeois of the Urban Coalition, tomorrow night on Night Call. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call to Jonathan Kozol about ghetto schools. Again, Del Shields.
We return to our guest, Mr. Jonathan Kozol, and this time we go out to Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Larson is hearing Night Call over WERE. Mr. Larson, good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen.
How are you?
Yeah, fine, thank you. Mr. Kozol, I have not read your book, so I don't know of your recommendations, but first of all, I would like to say that I am very sympathetic with everything you've said. I would like to address myself to perhaps something to what is unsaid, and that is these recommendations. I don't know what they are, as I say, but as a Caucasian, I would like to assure the black listeners that I am disturbed at the idea or any suggestion that they should strive to get into the white world, because if these black children are dying, perhaps it's only at an earlier age, but the white student as well is certainly dying also.
Yeah.
I mean, we have an extremely pathological culture here,
yeah,
as certainly the blacks know.
Well, and Mr. Larson, let me stop you first. Blacks in America are not trying to get into the white world.
No.
What they're hoping for is that maybe some of the benefits of this culture will become a few of their blessings. That's about all. I don't think
that
blacks right now, the whole specter has changed, and blacks are not trying to become whites.
I understand, Mr. Shields. Exactly. My point is that, on the contrary, that they should try to gain economic control. They have little choice. I mean, the white world, having all the economic power, the blacks have no choice. They must, this is the pathetic part of it, they must try to get into the white world, even though it's the last thing they should really do. So what I'm saying, in effect, is that they should try to gain control over the black communities, try to gain economic and whatever kind of control eventually, because the nature of white prejudice is so pathological that only a really a monumental miracle would, and it's not going to happen. I mean, you know, it, It would take a psychoanalysis of Western culture in order to resolve this problem so that integration could occur. So it seems to me the only alternative is for the blacks to try to gain control of their communities, control of their educational processes, and to create their own identity and to try to realize these beautiful qualities, these beautiful poetic and social and human qualities, which they can never realize in this white world. I mean, this is a cultural problem intrinsically, and a cultural problem. It's never addressed as such. And there's something absurd about comparing cultures. Mm. I mean, a culture is an end in itself. It's a universe. It's a universe in itself. It has its own values, and it cannot be compared. So this idea of what which whites do, I mean, the white regards the black man with a deep prejudice, that is even just perceiving, the way the white man perceives the black man without even any thought going into it,
yeah.
You know, is pathological.
Yeah.
It's pathological. I really think that, you know, the only alternative is for the black man to try to realize his own identity and to try to develop these beautiful qualities that he has.
I think you could add to that, not to quibble with you really, because I think, you know, we're in agreement, but I think a lot of black people in Boston would even, a lot of black people I've talked with all over the country would say, you know, let us realize all our qualities. They're not even all beautiful. You know, like, let us realize our beautiful qualities and also our mean qualities and also our in-between qualities. Let us be ourselves.
Well, of course.
Let us not be, you know, just like the lower middle class, you know, virginal school teacher there who's scared to death of us because, you know, because we're not like her. That's terrible. And, I'm reminded, and when I was fired from the system here, you know, the real reason was that I introduced poetry by a black man, Langston Hughes, and the school system suspected of being kind of radical. But they were jumped on immediately by the press. The press here is fairly enlightened, and so they tried to find other reasons, you know, and so they wouldn't say it was because he was black or because he was articulate or anything like that. They said it was because he wrote poetry in dialect, in Negro dialect, and or the phrase they used was native dialect, which is even more curious, native dialect. And they said that this will only reinforce the speech patterns of those kinds of children. And it's one of the primary goals of our school system is to break the speech patterns of the children. The verb they use was break. So you see the brutality,
exactly,
and the ignorance and the cruelty of this, that the teacher's doing this, damn it, would never realize that they were starving themselves of a discovery, because if they could just stop trying to break the speech patterns,
yes,
of those kinds of children,
they might
learn that, yes, there was a culture there which was in many cases much more exciting than their own. In Boston, one has grave doubts about who you're talking about when you speak of the culturally deprived, especially if you listen to our school committee.
Exactly.
Mr. Larson, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. This is Night Call in New York. This time we'll go to Boston. Mr. Gibson is hearing Night Call over WBUR-FM. Mr. Gibson, good evening, sir.
Good evening. I'd like to see if Mr. Kozol has some comments about the kind of teacher which I believe exists and need know exists in a school system like Boston, who is genuinely empathetic to the needs, situations of black students and other minority students as well, but for some reason, perhaps because of the way our political and organizational structure exists, cannot act,
mm-hmm,
on this empathy. Now, if I may, I would like to cite an example which I know of firsthand. I'm a Bostonian myself, though not in the city right now. I know a young woman who was a teacher in a grade school approximately on the same level that Mr. Kozol taught, who incidentally has read your book, as have I, and who finds your book absolutely correct, but somehow cannot agree with the way you presented your material. Be that as it may, let me cite an example that she told me occurred. She had a young boy in one of her classes who had some sort of a reading difficulty. I'm not sure. I believe it's called dysopsia or something.
Dyslexia, yeah. Dyslexia, that's right.
Yeah, it's a psychomotor difficulty,
right.
I believe. And when she discovered this, there apparently is federal money and federal programs for public schools to provide clinical help for this. She took her student or raised his case with her principal, who again was coordinator for a number of schools under this kind of program.
Yeah.
She was informed that it made, and I don't know how what trick of mental activity this took on the part of the principal, but it made his schools look bad if they reported too many kids with this kind of difficulty.
Yeah, did that come from the principal?
That came back from the principal to her, so
yeah.
She was told not to report him, and in turn the federal money was not granted, and the child got no clinical help.
Yeah.
Now again, he was in a situation where the teacher empathized with tremendously, was very mad about, as she was mad about conditions generally, and as I said, she agreed with your writing, but somehow couldn't become activated to do anything about it by herself or with other teachers.
Okay, well, you know, I think two things come to mind immediately. First of all, a teacher can do a certain number of things on her own, especially in a big school system like New York City. A school teacher can kind of get lost for a while and lose her supervisors, shake them at least long enough so she can do some things on her own. But in most areas, you can't do very much unless the principal is behind you. And this seems to me, and is just added evidence of the need, which has been emphasized repeatedly in recent months, for the principal, the administrator, the person in charge, to be somebody who is intimately responsive to the militant needs of people who are in trouble. In New York, occasionally, by accident, there has been such a principal, somebody like Elliot Shapiro, who's known at least to a good many people in the eastern area of the country, a man who really stuck out his neck. And his idea of being a good principal was not only to supervise the education in the school, but also to organize a rent strike on an unjust landlord in the neighborhood. But this happens very seldom, and this, it seems to me, is exactly why black people all around the country now demanding the right to have a say in who the principal is going to be. And this is why we've got this crisis that's been dominating the headlines in Boston for the past 2 weeks. It is why there's a crisis in New York City, and it's why there's been a crisis in a half dozen other cities recently over the same issue. And the teacher cannot do it without the principal. The community is smart to focus their attention on the principal. They don't need to have 40 black teachers in the school. All they need to have is a principal who is responsive to their demands, and then they can get the kind of school that they need and that they deserve. And the only other brief point I wanted to make is a great many people do say to me that they agree with the substance of my book, with the evidence, with the material, but that they don't go along with the way I say it. And I can understand this, because essentially what such people are saying to me is, I think you're right that things are wrong and things are unfair in these schools, but I can't go along with your rage, because I think in the long run, at the end, my book, comes to a kind of terrible rage.
Mr. Gibson and Mr. Kozel, we're so sorry, but time has run out.
That's fine.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Kozel, we want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call, and I do hope that all of the comments that were made tonight, that our Night Call listeners have listened attentively and perhaps something can be done. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, Saving Our Cities with something new called the Block Partnership with Donald Bourgeois of the Urban Coalition. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.